morning, the big picture of the Bible on the subject of how God punishes nations. And if you don't have a copy of the outline, they're actually on the table out there. We're going to be covering a lot of territory this morning. But the reason we're doing this is because if you understand the big picture of the Bible and how God does indeed punish nations, then it helps you understand the book of Revelation much easier. So I'm working on the outline right now that's entitled God's Judgment Upon the Nations. I'm going to start here in Jeremiah chapter 18, verse 7. He says, "The innocent I speak concerning a nation and concerning a kingdom to pluck up, to pull down, to destroy it." I just wanted to open this lesson with this particular verse because I'm wanting you to realize there are instances in history and in time when God does indeed intercede, and he is the one who punishes the nation. He is the one who tears down the nation. And so the question that we ask is, exactly how does God do this when God tears down a nation? Exactly in what way does he do it? The first example I have here for you is just a brief summary of the 10 plagues that came upon Egypt. This is the first example that we have of God punishing a nation, and that is whenever God was trying to get the Pharaoh to let the children of Israel go. And so I've just listed them down here. The water turned to blood, that's the first one. Frogs, lice, flies. The cattle died, fire mingled with hail, locusts, thick darkness, and the death of the firstborn. Now, if you just take these 10 plagues and just break them down into categories, you'll find that one of the main categories has to do with famine, just the removal of the food. For instance, whenever you talk about the water turned to blood, well, then what's in the water dies. When you talk about the cattle dying, then you're removing the food. When you talk about the fire mingled with hail, that's the removal of the food. When you talk about the locust, that's the removal of the food. And so what you're dealing with here is famine. And then when you talk about flies and lice and boils, that's pestilence. And then at the very end, the death of the firstborn. And so you're going to be seeing that you're going to have this pattern going all the way, starting with Egypt, all the way through to the book of Revelation. There is a text in the Old Testament, and that's Deuteronomy 28, where God lays down within the covenant that he made with the children of Israel. He talks to them about how he is going to punish them if they do not keep their end of the covenant. The 28th chapter of Deuteronomy is where you find this. And in that text, you have listed the blessings and the curses of the covenant. And so now I'm reading from Deuteronomy chapter 28 on the outline. These are the curses of Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 through 18. But it shall come to pass if you do not obey the voice of the Lord. Now I'm just going to read what I've got underlined in bold print just to save time on the class, because I'm just trying to get to the main crux of the matter. All these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Now, verse 17. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Then in verse 18, the produce of your land, the increase of your cattle, and the offspring of your flocks. What you're dealing with here, again, is the diminishing of the food. When you go to chapter 28, 38 through 39, you shall carry much seed out to the field, but gather little in, for the locusts shall consume it. You shall plant vineyards and tend them, but you shall neither drink of the wine nor gather the grapes, for the worm shall eat them. So what I'm wanting you to see here is in the curses of the covenant, one of the main sections of the curses is the removal of the food, famine. And then going back to Deuteronomy 28 now, 21 through 22, the Lord will make the plague to cling to you until he has consumed you. Then verse 22, the Lord will strike you with the consumption, with the fever, with inflammation, with severe burning fever, with the sword, with scorching, and with mildew. And so here I just categorized these particular verses under the word pestilence, where you've got diseases now that are wiping them out. And then the third way in which God was punishing a nation under Deuteronomy 28, in 28 verse 41, it says, they shall go into captivity. And then in Deuteronomy 28, 49, the Lord will bring a nation against you from afar. And so here in Deuteronomy 28, in the middle of the covenant that God makes with the children of Israel, he has listed the curses of the covenant if they do not keep their end of the covenant, and you can summarize it with famine, pestilence, and military conquest. And so now whenever you go down to the way in which God did indeed punish Israel, You find this in the book of Jeremiah and Ezekiel when God punished Israel in 587 B.C. In Jeremiah 14, verse 12, it says, I will consume them by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence. So there you have it laid out in a very succinct way in which God is going to punish them. Three words are used, famine, pestilence, and the sword. When you go to Jeremiah 44, verse 13, I have punished Jerusalem by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence. Actually, that verse right there pretty much summarizes what we're going to be studying the rest of this section right here. When you go to Ezekiel 5, 12, one-third of you shall die of the pestilence and be consumed with famine in your midst. One-third of you shall fall by the sword all around you, and I will scatter another third to all the winds, and I will draw out the sword after them. Then Ezekiel 14, 21, my four severe judgments on Jerusalem, the sword and famine and wild beast and pestilence. And then finally Joel 2, 10. The earth quakes before them, the heavens tremble, the sun, the moon grow dark, and the stars diminish their brightness. Now, I wanted to put Joel 2:10 in here because I'm wanting you to realize that in connection with the famine, the pestilence, and the military conquest is also the concept and the idea of the sun, the moon, and the stars not giving their light. And so here you have darkness. Even when you go back to Egypt, the ninth plague was darkness, thick darkness. And so it shouldn't surprise you that whenever you're getting down to God's punishment of nations, that also included in the famine and the pestilence and the military conquest, is indeed darkness. Okay, just flip the page over, and you'll see the way in which God punished Israel in 70 AD. And again, this is just Matthew 24 is where I'm reading from, Matthew 24, 7 through 8. For nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famine, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. You know, a lot of times, as a matter of fact, this past week, I was studying with a young man, and he made reference to Matthew 24, and he says, this is talking about the end of the time and what's going on right now. You need to understand Matthew 24 is dealing with the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. And he tells us how it's going to be taking place, and again, he talks about the famines and the pestilence. And then he says in verse 29 of Matthew 24, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven. And so even dealing with the punishment of Israel and Judah in 70 A.D. in Jerusalem, he talks about the sun and the moon and the stars not giving their light. Now I'm going back and showing you two more instances of God punishing nations from the Old Testament that you may not be familiar with. And again, we're just going to briefly look at these just so you can see the big picture here. This is God speaking of his punishment of Babylon, and this is found in the book of Isaiah in chapter 13. He speaks of the burden against Babylon. And he says, for the stars of heaven and the constellations will not give their light. The sun will be darkened in its goings forth, and the moon will not cause its light to shine. And then he says in verse 17, behold, I will stir up the Medes against them. And so you're dealing with military conquest of the Babylonian Empire. And again, he speaks of it being a time when the sun and the moon are not giving their light. And then you have the punishment of God of Egypt mentioned in Ezekiel. He says, a lamentation for Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He says, I will cover the heavens and make it stars dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. And then Ezekiel 32, 11, the sword of the king of Babylon shall come upon you. And so here he talks about the military conquest of Egypt. But he mentions this again about there being the darkening of the stars and the sun and the moon. Are you seeing a pattern already? All I'm trying to show you is the big picture pattern of God's punishment of nations. There's a pattern. You see it starting in Egypt. You see it in dealing with God's punishment of Israel in 587. Again, of Israel in 70 AD. God's punishment of Babylon. God's punishment of Egypt. There is a pattern. And the pattern is famine, pestilence, military conquest, and the darkening of the sun and the moon. Now, I told you we're going to cook on this. Now, just go to the third page. In the third page, we're dealing again with God's punishment and the wrath of God as it's revealed in the book of Revelation. What we're doing now is summarizing what we've already gone over. We've already studied the seven seals. We've already studied the seven trumpets. We've already studied the seven bowls of wrath. We did that 2 weeks ago. And so what I want you to do right now is just pull back again and just see the big picture of the book of Revelation, because the text of the book of Revelation that is the most difficult is found within these seven seals, seven trumpets, and seven bowls of wrath. And if you understand how God punishes nations in time past, and you understand that, then it helps you understand this text a whole lot easier. Now, that being said, let's go to the outline. I'm reading from Revelation 6 and 8. He says, "So I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him, and power was given them over the fourth of the earth to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and with the beast of the earth." Those are the exact same four mentioned back in Ezekiel, by the way. Now, what I've done for you here is I've basically summarized these sections from the book of Revelation. I've put together the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls of wrath all together under their headings. For instance, in Revelation 6, 1 through 4, he says, "Now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals." Again, I'm reading what's just underlined in bold print. "He went out conquering and to conquer." And then verse 3, "The second seal, to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another, and there was given him a great sword." And so when you're dealing with the seals, you're dealing with conquering and to conquer and the sword. And then you're getting down to the sixth angel. He says he released to kill a third of mankind. When you get down to Revelation 16, 12, he's talking about the sixth bowl being poured out. He says, "So that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared." What I've been trying to show you and teach you over and over again is the seven seals, the seven trumpets, the seven bowls of wrath are saying the same thing. They're not different messages. They are a repeat of the message being said three times. There's a reason for this, because in the Hebrew world, the way in which you do superlatives is by repeating. For instance, you have the holy place in the temple. In the back of the temple where only the high priest is allowed to go, what's that called? The Holy of Holies, the duplication of it. But what is God referred to as? Holy, holy, holy. The triplication is the highest level. And so you have single, duplication, triplication. That's the way in which the Hebrews expressed their superlatives. You also will find that whenever you go over, even back to the book of Exodus, wherever the Pharaoh dreams twice, and he dreams, you know, about the seven lean cows and the seven fat cows and the seven fat ears and the seven blighted ears, he tells Pharaoh that the two dreams are one. The two dreams are one, and that they are repeated so that they will know that when it happens, it is the hand of God that God is about to do very soon. So the reason I'm showing you that is because the same thing is taking place here in the book of Revelation. It is a repeating. It is not different things being talked about. It is saying the same thing different ways, triplicating it to where it's understood this is the hand of God that is taking place here, so that whenever the famine comes, it's not coincidence. Whenever the pestilence comes, it's not coincidence. Whenever the military conquest comes, it's not coincidence. It is the will of God and God doing it. All right, now going back to Revelation 6 under the subheading famine. It says, "He opened the third seal," and again, I'm just reading what's in bold print, "a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and wine." Now, Revelation 8 and 7, "The first angel sounded, and hail and fire followed, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up." By the way, have you ever heard about that hail and fire before coming out of heaven? That goes all the way back to Egypt, doesn't it? Yes. And then going now down to Revelation 16, 8 through 9. "The fourth angel poured out his bowl on the sun, and power was given to him to scorch men with fire." Revelation 18, 8. "Therefore her plagues will come in one day," and one of those he lists as being famine. And then Revelation 8, 8 through 9, "The second angel sounded, a third of the sea became blood, a third of the living creatures in the sea died." All right, what I just did right there was I covered the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls of wrath. They're all saying the same thing. They're all discussing, in those particular verses, famine, the removal of the food and the water, the removal of the food on the land. And then going back to Revelation 8 now, verses 10 through 11, under the subheading pestilence, he says, "The third angel sounded, the name of the star is wormwood, a third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the water because it was made bitter." Going over to Revelation 16, 2, "So the first went and poured out his bowl upon the earth, a foul and loathsome sore came upon men who had the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. And then going over to Revelation 16:10, then the fifth angel poured out his bowl, and they gnawed their tongues because of their pain. And so here you have pestilence. You can break down the punishments in the book of Revelation under famine, pestilence, military conquest. But it doesn't stop there. If you flip the page over, you'll find on the very back, the fourth page, the darkening of the sun. Now, have we seen the darkening of the sun any time in the past when God punished nations? Yes, in every single one of them, actually. You have it mentioned in Egypt. You have it mentioned in Israel in 587 B.C. You have it mentioned in Israel in 70 A.D. You have it mentioned when God punished Babylon. You have it mentioned when God punished Egypt. So there's five examples from the Old Testament of the concept and the idea of there being days of darkness whenever this is coming. So in Revelation 6, 12 through 17, again, I'm just reading what's underlined. He says, the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood. That's chapter 6. When you go over to chapter 8 of Revelation, the sun was struck, and it's dealing with the fourth angel sounding. The sun was struck, a third of the moon, a third of the stars, and a third of them were darkened. Okay, now this is actually, you probably don't remember the class from 2 weeks ago, but it was somebody making a comment about this particular thing. And I told them that there was a history book that I read years ago. I like reading history. That's what I do for entertainment. I know that's kind of nerdy, but I like reading history. Anyhow, when I was reading Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, I came across this. And so I typed this down for you. And this is Gibbon's explaining to us events that happened that led to the downfall of the Roman Empire. The gloomy period of history has been decorated, excuse me, I'm going to have to pick this up because this is old English kind of a certain way. It uses big words here. This gloomy period of history has been decorated with inundations, earthquakes, uncommon meteor, preternatural darkness. But a long and general famine was a calamity of a more serious kind. It was the inevitable consequence of a rampant and oppression which extirpated the produce of the present and the hope of the future harvest. Famine is almost always followed by epidemical diseases, the effect of scanty and unwholesome food. Other causes must, however, have contributed to furious plague, which from the year 250 to 265 raged without interruption in every province, every city, and almost every family of the Roman Empire. During some time, 5,000 persons died daily in Rome, and many towns that had escaped the hands of the barbarians were entirely depopulated. We might suspect that war, pestilence, and famine had consumed in a few years the moiety of the human species. So, you know, when I read that, and you know I'm a history buff, and you also know that I'm familiar with the Bible and how God said he was going to punish the Roman Empire with famine, pestilence, military conquest, and darkness. So when I read this text here in Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, it just kind of stood out in my mind because he mentions quite straightforward war, pestilence, and famine. And if you don't know, as I've already tried to teach you this morning, the war, the famine, and the pestilence, that's the way in which God punishes nations. Now, can y'all believe we made it through 4 pages in 10 minutes? The reason we did that is because I've taught you this already before. That this is nothing new. I'm just summarizing for you what we've already gone over. We're pulling back, seeing the big picture. All right. There is another outline you hope you have. If you're new students and you don't know this, whenever you come into the building, look at the table. On the table will be the sermon outlines for the day and also the classes for the day. And today, right now, we're going to go back to where we left off. And that is in Revelation 16 and talking about the Battle of Armageddon. Okay. How many of you have heard of Armageddon? Better question might be, who hasn't heard of Armageddon? All right. What we're going to be doing now today, we're going to be studying what is meant by the Battle of Armageddon. And the premillennial world, this is really big to them. And they have the idea that all the armies of the earth are going to be gathered together over in Israel in the Valley of Jezreel. And you're going to have the Chinese and the Russians and the Americans and everybody else coming into this valley. And they're going to have this great big battle that's going to initiate the introduction of the, basically, the Great Tribulation, as they would call it. All right, so let's see exactly what the Bible does teach about Armageddon. From Revelation 16, 14 through 16, we're going to slow down now and get into our regular pace. He says, "For they are spirits of demons performing signs, which go out to the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. Behold, I am coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he walk naked and see his shame." And they gathered them together to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon. Okay, the place where the battle is going to take place is called Armageddon, and it's called the Battle of the Great Day of God Almighty. And so, in the book of Revelation, you have a war taking place. The war is actually in the spiritual dimension between God and Satan. And there are physical ramifications of the spiritual war. The physical ramifications for the Christians is the fact that the Roman Empire is trying to get the Christians to worship the statue of the Emperor Domitian. And that those who refuse to worship the statue of the Emperor are being killed. The physical manifestation of the spiritual war is that Christians are dying for their faith. The way it's put over in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison. You will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life. Okay, I got a question for you. How is a spiritual being going to come and grab people and drag them and put them in prison? He's not. He's going to be working through physical people. Okay, please let that sink in. You've got a spiritual being working through physical people. Who are the physical people? They are the Roman Empire and the kings of the earth under the control of the Roman Empire. And so you've got the Roman Empire and the military and the power of the Roman Empire now coming in and basically making war against the church. This Domitian is doing the devil's work. That's a very good way of looking at it. Matter of fact, when you go back to Revelation 13, it talks about that the authority and the power of the dragon is behind this individual. That he is working through this individual. Okay, so when you realize that what Revelation is describing is a war, then it shouldn't surprise you that in a text that is dealing with spiritual warfare, that you're going to have this terminology used, the great battle, going back and reading what I've underlined, the gathering together for the battle of that great day of God Almighty, the big battle, if you will, and it is referred to as the Battle of Armageddon. All right. In Hebrew, the Hebrew word for mountain is har. We would spell it H-R, har. And that's where they get the term R. It's really pronounced Harmageddon. And then the Mageddon is actually the city of Megiddo. If you have any knowledge of the geography of Israel, you know that Israel is this little strip of land running basically as the connection between the east and the west of the Fertile Crescent. In the ancient times, in the Fertile Crescent, the reason it's called a crescent is because it's in the shape of the crescent moon, you have where civilization basically grew up and was built around the rivers of the Euphrates, the Tigris, and the Nile. And so as a consequence of that, you had strong human civilization and empires in Egypt, and strong human civilization and empires in Mesopotamia. In the Mesopotamian world, there were many different kingdoms. There was the initial Babylonian, and then later on the Assyrian, and then during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, it was called the Neo-Babylonian, and then the Medo-Persian. All of those are over here around the Tigris and the Euphrates. Well, if you wanted to go from the east to the west in the Fertile Crescent, you didn't go across the Arabian desert because there's not water and you die. And so they understood if we want to go from Mesopotamia over to Egypt, you go up here at the top of the Fertile Crescent where it comes up against the Mediterranean Sea, and there's this little strip of land that connects the two sides. That little strip of land is what we call Israel. And so, as you can imagine, Israel was the crossroads of the ancient world. And so if there was going to be warfare between Egypt And any kingdom over in Mesopotamia, they had to go through Israel. Now, there were two ways you could travel through Israel. One way, you could go down to the Gulf of Aqaba and come up through, actually, the Red Sea, go around the Sinai Peninsula, come up to the Gulf of Aqaba, and go up what's called the King's Highway. You had to have boats to do that, and a lot of boats, especially if you're carrying an army. And sometimes that's the way in which people would travel, down the King's Highway, down to the Gulf of Aqaba, and then sail around the Sinai Peninsula, come up the Red Sea, and come into Egypt that way. But if you wanted to go by land, then the way in which you went by land, there was, and there is, a chain of mountains that runs down the center of the land of Israel. And it's very difficult traveling through the mountains. But over on the seashore, close to the seashore of Israel, it's flat. And you can travel very easily along the seashore. In the northern part of Israel, there is a valley that cuts across the mountain range. And that valley is called the Valley of Jezreel. Now, just try to visualize this. If you want to go across from Mesopotamia, you come down, and there's this great big valley, the Valley of Jezreel, that cuts straight across through the mountains, and it's flat. And it goes all the way over to the seashore, and then you can go down the seashore. This is the way the armies travel. When the armies traveled from the east to the west, they all went through the Valley of Jezreel. They did not want to try to carry their armies on boats. So they stayed on land. You go through the Valley of Jezreel, you go over to the seashore, and you go down, you attack Egypt. Or you bring your army up from Egypt, and you go across the Valley of Jezreel, and then you go up and you attack Assyria or Samaria or Babylon, some kingdom over here in the east. But if you're going from east to west with your army, you got to go through the Valley of Jezreel. Okay, and it's a great big valley. At the turning point where you basically go all the way down to the seashore and you turn left, you know, if you say, you know, give me a map of how to get to Egypt, well, you go down to this Valley of Jezreel, and when you get down there to the city of Megiddo, you take a left. All right, well, Megiddo is right here where it turns left. Where you come all the way down through the Valley of Jezreel, and you're finally here down by the seashore, close to the sea, and then you're turning around to the left and going down the flatlands. That's where Megiddo is located. And so, as a consequence, the Valley of Jezreel is also sometimes referred to as pertaining to Megiddo, and it's called Mount Megiddo, Har Megiddo, Armageddon, Armageddon. All right, y'all got that? That wasn't hard to see, was it? Armageddon, Mount Megiddo, Megiddo, the city where you turn left to go down by the flatlands, by the Mediterranean Sea, with your army. And so as a consequence, this is where you get Armageddon from. Now, the reason it's called Armageddon, I'm going to give y'all some phrases, and let's see. History buffs, please speak up. He's met his Waterloo. What does that mean?
Where Napoleon lost.
All right. That's where Napoleon lost. Okay. What does that mean today to us when someone says he's met his Waterloo? Come on, David.
That's where he lost his decisive battle.
So what does it mean today for us? And when someone, have you ever heard something, maybe you've never heard someone say that or heard it. He's met his Waterloo. What that means is you finally came up against the big battle that you lost. All right, you see, the point I'm trying to make is we have sayings today even that are connected to major military battles in history. You need to understand, with the Valley of Jezreel being located where it is, and being a valley where if you wanted to carry your army from the east to the west, it became an extremely important location militarily wise. And you wanted to control this location. Anybody here ever play Risk? You want to control the gaps where everything comes together and it bottlenecks. You want to try to control that area. It's kind of like if we had a war right now, we would want control over the Panama Canal. You want control over where you travel through, which is control extremely important militarily, strategically speaking. As a consequence of that, through history, the history of Israel, and even after history, this particular valley has been where multitudes of battles have been fought. And so now let's just go to the outline and read with me from the outline. And again, what I'm trying to do is give you some historical understanding of Megiddo and the Valley of Jezreel. It says, in that day there should be a great, I'm reading from Zechariah 12, 11. In that day there should be a great mourning in Jerusalem like the mourning of Hadad Ramon in the plain of Megiddo. Okay, you may be thinking, well, what's he making reference to? He's making reference to a battle that took place in the Valley of Megiddo, in the plain of Megiddo. In Judges 5, 19 through 20, the king came and fought, the kings of Canaan fought in Taanach by the waters of Megiddo. They took no spoils of silver. They fought from the heavens. The stars from their courses fought against Sisera. All right, let's see how many Bible students we have here. Does anybody remember Sisera? Remember the guy falling asleep? The woman taking the tent peg and pop, nailing it through his head. All right, where did Dallas Hall take place? The Valley of Megiddo. The Valley of Jezreel. That's the battle that took place in the time of Judges. All right, Judges 6:33. Then all the Midianites and Amalekites and the people of the east gathered together and they crossed over and encamped in the Valley of Jezreel. Okay. Does anybody remember Gideon? Gideon and his 300 soldiers? Do you think Israel may have, you know, for some reason or another, had a special memory of Gideon? And what happened with Gideon and 300 soldiers in the Valley of Jezreel? You couldn't even count. The Valley of Jezreel was filled with the armies and the camels of just countless thousands and thousands. And this is where Gideon and his 300 men separated into camps of 100 and, you know, blew the trumpets and lit their torches all together at one time, and the armies attacked each other. The enemy attacked each other and destroyed each other. That battle took place in the Valley of Jezreel. Okay, are you beginning to see a pattern? The battle with Sisera, Jezreel. Back here with Hadad Ramon, the plain of Megiddo. Here we're dealing again with the Midianites and Amalekites and Gideon. That is the Valley of Jezreel. Okay, 2 Kings 9:22. And when Ahaziah, king of Judah, saw this, he fled by the road to Beth Hagan. So Jehu pursued him and said, shoot him also in the chariot. And they shot him at the ascent of Gur, which is by Eblim. Then he fled to Megiddo and died there. And so here you have the death of King Ahaziah, and where he dies is in Megiddo. This is where Jehu, if you're not familiar with Old Testament history, Jehu is the one that overthrew the family of Ahab. He was the one that was anointed king and told overthrow the family of Ahab. And so here you have Jehu securing his throne. And again, where is it taking place? It's around Megiddo. This next one is a very important event. This is in 2 Kings 23, 29 through 30. In his days, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went to the aid of the king of Assyria, to the river Euphrates. And King Josiah went against him, and Pharaoh Necho killed him at Megiddo when he confronted him. Then his servants moved his body in a chariot from Megiddo, brought him to Jerusalem, and buried him in his own tomb. And the people of the land took Jehoahaz, son of Josiah, anointed him, and made him king in his father's place. Okay, again, from 2 Chronicles 35, 22. Nevertheless, Josiah would not turn his face from him, but disguised himself so that he might fight with him, and did not heed the words of Necho from the mouth of God. He came to fight in the valley of Megiddo. All right. If you were going to pick one king of Judah other than David, who was the greatest king? Josiah. That's an easy call. Josiah was the greatest king. Nobody like him. Nobody even close. And during this time, The Assyrian Empire is the big world empire. If you don't know this, the Assyrians were extremely cruel. Whenever they conquered a city, basically they would kill everybody in it by torturing them publicly. And this is what they were known for. If you fight against them and they conquer you, you're tortured and you're killed. So you surrender and they will be kind to you and make you a slave. All right. Pharaoh Necho is in power in Egypt, and he is basically a puppet of the king of Assyria. Assyria is being attacked by the Babylonian Empire now, combined with the Medes. The Medes and the Babylonians now are coming up and attacking the Assyrian Empire, and Pharaoh Necho is trying to come to their aid. Josiah understands the significance of what's about to happen, that here is an army coming to support the Assyrians, and he's trying to bring about the downfall of the Assyrian Empire. And so he goes out with his small army and fights against a much larger army. You really, if you don't know this in history, I'm just going to tell you the story. You know, we have these events in history where we talk about, for instance, the 300 Greeks. Okay, y'all familiar with that? You know, the 300 Greeks that fought and died to keep the Medo-Persians from coming in. All right. They knew they were going to lose, but they fought anyway. This is an event that happened with Josiah. They were going out against a much larger army. And it was understood, you're going to get beat. It was even told by God, you're going to get beat. But he went anyway. And they went anyway. And they fought. And they died. They didn't win the battle, but they slowed Pharaoh Necho down long enough that the Assyrians were defeated. And the Assyrian army and the Assyrian empire collapsed. So they lost the battle, but they won the bigger goal. Does that make sense? They died for a larger goal. And that was the way Josiah died. Basically, understanding this is a suicide mission. We're going to lose, but we're going to slow him down. Maybe long enough to where he can't get there. And they will lose in Assyria. And Assyria did indeed lose. So his battle was not for anything at all. It accomplished its primary end goal. Do you see, by the way, let me give you some more. Does anybody know what valley possibly Saul was killed in? And Jonathan? Kind of easy answer, what are you studying right now? Yes, valley. You say the valley of Jezreel. Yes, that's correct. I've taught my children through the years, if you don't know the city, and I ask you what city did this happen in, just say Shechem, and you're 90% chance of being right. If so, if I ever say what valley did this battle take place in, if you don't know, just say the Valley of Jezreel, and you got about a 90% chance of being right. And so King Saul is killed there. Jonathan is killed there. Josiah is killed there. This is where you have the battle with the 300 against the Amalekites. This is where Sisera fought. There are countless major battles in Israeli history that took place in this particular location. So whenever you say to a Jew or a Hebrew, the Valley of Megiddo, the Battle of Megiddo, the Battle of Armageddon, Mount Megiddo, the Battle of Jezreel, pick any of them. You could call it the same thing in any different way. They all understood what you meant. The big battle. The big battle that turns the tide of the war. Does that make sense? If any of you are military history buffs, if you're a military history buff, you know the big battles in the different Civil War, Second World War, First World War. You know the big battles that turn the tide. All right. Whenever a Jew heard the Battle of Armageddon, this is a symbol by this time in history. The same way we say the Battle of Waterloo, when they say the Battle of Armageddon, it is understood not necessarily the literal physical battle is going to take place in this location as much as the big battle is going to take place here. The big battle is going to be determining the direction and who's going to win the war. So I got a question for you. From the book of Revelation, who's going to win the war? God is. And you need to understand, the battle is between God and Satan. could we see the war that took place in heaven in Revelation 12? No. We're just told about it. And so when you go back to the very top of this, it says, to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty. The battle is God's battle. And you're going to be seeing when we get over to the 19th chapter, when we look at the, by the way, the battle is mentioned in the 19th chapter. It is spoken about here in the 16th chapter. The last page of the outline that I've given you, we'll try to look at next week, is Revelation 19, 11 through 12, through 21. That's the battle. The battle is pronounced in the 16th chapter. The battle is fought in the 19th chapter. So it's not something that's going to take place in the future. The battle's already been fought. And it's talked about in the 19th chapter. And so we will look at that later on next week when we get down and look at the battle of Armageddon in greater detail next week. Let's go ahead and read this bottom verse here in Revelation 19. I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. So what you have described here in Revelation 19 is this battle that's mentioned back in chapter 16 called the Battle of Armageddon. Here it is brought up again in the 19th chapter. And on one side, you've got the beast, you've got the kings of the earth, you've got their armies. And they're coming to make war against him who sits on the horse and against his army. Just previews of coming attractions. Anybody got any idea who may be sitting on the horse, the white horse? Christ and his army, who are arrayed in white robes. So when we've got Christ sitting on his white horse and we've got his army who are in white robes, are we dealing with something that is in our physical world where there's an army of white horses over in the Valley of Jezreel? Or is this symbolic of what's happening in the spiritual dimension? This is the spiritual dimension. You've got Christ, the one who's leading the battle with his army. So what I'm trying to point out to you is there is a spiritual war taking place here, and the two sides are finally hitting heads head on. And the question is, who's going to win the war? Well, in the 19th chapter next week, we'll see. Okay? That's a good way to stop right there. Next week, we're going to be studying the 19th chapter, the battle that took place between God, his captain, Jesus Christ. And since I've already told you that, then just go ahead and read the outline, and we may even go into the 20th chapter next week.